Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, harvesting the fruits of 40 years of ecumenical dialogue. And a special celebration in the Vatican marks the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. While much has been done over the past six decades to promote human rights around the world, hundreds of millions of our brothers and sisters still see their rights to life, liberty and security threatened. Those were Pope Benedict's words on Wednesday as he attended a special commemoration here in the Vatican of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on December the 10th, 1948. During the afternoon event, prizes were awarded to individuals and organizations that have been actively promoting human rights and development in different countries around the world. And the evening concluded with a concert and address by Pope Benedict. Lydia O'Kane followed events for us in the Paul VI Audience Hall.
The dignity of every person is guaranteed only when all his or her fundamental rights are recognized, protected, and promoted. Those were the words of Pope Benedict XVI following a concert to mark the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Even today, he said, this declaration remains the highest point of reference of intercultural dialogue on freedom and on the rights of man. The Holy Father went on to say that ultimately, human rights have their roots in God the Creator, who has given everyone intelligence and liberty. If this fact is ignored, he continued, human rights remain fragile because they lack a solid foundation.
I diritti dell'uomo sono pertanto ultimamente fondati in Dio Creatore.
Music has been described as the universal language of mankind, so it seemed fitting that the Pope and the audience in the Paul VI Hall on Wednesday evening were treated to a performance by the Brandenburg State Orchestra of Frankfurt under the baton of Inmar Schara, which included works by Mendelssohn and Mozart to mark this anniversary. An anniversary, said Pope Benedict, that offers an occasion to re-evaluate in what measure this declaration is respected today in the different national legislations and in the consciences of individuals and collectively.
Indubbiamente un lungo cammino è stato già percorso, ma ne resta ancora un lungo tratto da completare.
Undoubtedly, he added, great strides have been made, but there is still a long way to go to ensure that the human rights of hundreds of millions of people are protected. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Before that rousing performance with the young Spanish composer Inmar Schara, the first woman to conduct a concert here in the Vatican, the Holy See's Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, outlined the Church's continuing concern for all the fundamental rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration. Also speaking about the importance of that declaration today was the Director General of the International Labour Organization, Juan Somavia, son-in-law of one of the signatories of the original document 60 years ago.
My attachment to the declaration is nurtured by the memory of my father-in-law, Hernán Santa Cruz. He was the first ambassador of Chile to the United Nations and one of the drafters of the declaration and promoter of the provisions of economic, social, and cultural rights.
With a lifelong commitment to peace and justice, both in his native Chile and on the international stage, Dr. Somavia told us that the Church's work in promoting its social doctrine is an essential part of the human rights picture today.
I think that we have to understand that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the social doctrine of the Church, the Constitution, the policies of the ILO, all converge on human dignity and the dignity of work. And I think that if we look at the financial crisis, the crisis of the real economy that has become a jobs crisis globally, we have to all agree that we have to put, again, the creation of jobs and the dignity of work at the heart of the economic, social, and environmental policies. That's the biggest challenge. Too many people in the world still have a strong deficit in terms of their human rights and in the deficit in terms of decent work, which is what we pursue in the ILO. And consequently, the testimony of the social doctrine of the church, the testimony of the ILO, looking for the policies, looking for the main instruments that can permit you to move forward, is essential. Basically, social protection today for the people that are suffering and the most weak and the most vulnerable, protection of jobs, and if jobs are going to be created, make sure that you have the social protection behind it. Stimulus packages that help create jobs, particularly in smaller enterprises, but also in infrastructure, investment in health services, investment in community services, you know, the capacity coming from the state, because the private sector is now at this moment caught, except for the small enterprises that we have to push strongly. All of these things are feasible, but we have to make sure that the policies go in the sense of helping people get a job and helping people that are out of a job, and particularly those living in the informal economy who do not have access to social protection. And consequently, the poor people in the world are the ones that are going to suffer most, which explains, naturally, in these circumstances, the preferential option for the poor of the social doctrine of the church.
Dr. Juan Somavia there, Director General of the International Labour Organization. Following the formal speeches, the head of the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council, Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, presented awards to the winners of a human rights prize set up in memory of the late Vietnamese Cardinal François Van Thuan. An individual award was given to the former president of the Red Cross, Cornelio Somaruga, while four other prizes were presented to the founders of development projects here in Rome, in the Amazon, in Uganda, and in Madagascar.
When there are families that are, you know, they have found again the strength to be autonomous and so on, he gives them a small amount of money so that they can go back in their original place in Madagascar to buy a piece of land.
A couple of years ago, Anne Aubert and her husband were on holiday in Madagascar when they discovered the inspiring work of Father Pedro Opeka, one of the recipients of the 2008 Cardinal Van Thuan Award.
Father Pedro was working in the south of the country in a very, very poor area. And he started there 35 years ago.
So he was a missionary, wasn't
he? Yeah, he was a missionary, exactly. And in 89, he was sent back to Antananarivo, which is the capital of Madagascar. And then he started to see all the poor people that were going to the garbage area that is on a hill near the city. You know, there is this huge place which is completely open air, where they bring all the garbage from the city, and it's burning day and night long, so it's also creating a lot of poisoning smells and so on. And there he saw that there were thousands of people that were, you know, people sleeping on the streets, and they were looking in this place for food, for a place to sleep. There were even created houses underneath the garbage area, and also like creating tunnels, just to find a place where they could survive, basically.
So incredibly dangerous and
exactly.
Difficult conditions,
yes,
with the smoke and the
yes,
poisonous fumes.
And sometimes the place where these tunnels that they created, they would, you know, collapse, and so some people, of course, died in this situation. So he was completely horrified by what he saw, and he started to go there every day and to try to help them and to get their trust also, because they were like outside the society, you know, completely living on their own. So slowly and slowly he began to talk with them and to say, you know, you need to find another life. You cannot live like this without dignity. So all his work was based on the fact that people need to find, these poor people, they need to find again their dignity, because like this they are not human being anymore, because they are completely living in a such terrible situation that they lose every connection with human values and human rights and so on. So he started to help them to create houses where he could have them sleeping there rather than in the garbage. And he started to get some funding from Austria, which was the first country to help them, and also some NGOs that were working in Madagascar. So this started in 1989. In 20 years, he created 5 villages around Antananarivo, all around this hill where there is a garbage area. And in these 5 villages, there are almost 20,000 people living now.
20,000 people?
Yes. And what he did with all the funding he got in these 20 years is that he built hospitals, schools. So this community, he called it Akamasu, which means in Malagasy, it means good friend. And he also created a Malgash association to support this work. No, and he has 400 persons working with him, all from the country, all Malgash people.
Anne Aubert there, who now helps to run a non-profit organisation supporting the work of Padre Pedro in Madagascar. Another of the projects recognised by the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council for its work in support of human rights is the so-called Gulu Nap Initiative, in which doctors from Naples University support and train doctors working in Gulu in the north of Uganda. Now in its 5th year, the first 50 doctors from the Faculty of Medicine there are expected to graduate next year. Just before the awards ceremony began, I sat down in our studios here with paediatrician Dr. Luigi Greco from Naples University, with the Vice-Chancellor of Gulu University, Dr. Jack Nieko Pemoge, and with the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine there, Dr. Jasper Ogwalo-Keng.
Yeah, in Gulu, like most of Uganda, the problem is the same. You have child malnutrition, malaria. Some time ago, there used to be outbreaks of cholera when people were cramped in the camps. Then the other problems were really traumas because of the war. We used to get children who were abducted and beaten up, and a few cases of gunshot wounds. Of course, the rates of HIV and AIDS, which is a well-known pandemic, and we found it easier as a public health workers to work in Gulu, because people are put in the camps and easy to reach. When you want to mobilize them, it's very, very easy. So cases of immunization for the children and the cases of antenatal care for mothers has been relatively easy. In fact, Gulu, during the difficult time, had the highest rate of success in the maternal health and the rate of immunization, because everybody's cramped up in one place and it's easy to reach them. With time in the camps also, hygiene was improved because there was water made available, so that it's not as bad as one hears from outside.
Tell us about the kind of progress then. You're also talking about malnutrition, but that presumably is improving too a little if people are beginning to cultivate now.
Apparently, in areas where people have gone back, people are now having food. People have produced food. But then what the problem now is that when people were in the camp, it was easy for us health people to reach the people. But the last report from, I think, UN, we found that now there are increased medical problems with people who have gone back because they are not easily accessible. Mm-hmm. Gulu University has responded. We have our students now completing the medical doctor's program, but our training was really heavily based with the community. And we are now having our students going to cover some of those health centers where people have gone back.
Professor Greco,
Luigi Greco.
You have been very involved in this project from the beginning, haven't you? Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the involvement of Naples University with this project there in Uganda.
When I was called in December, 12th of December 2003, because it was available a fund from a sale of rice from Italy to Uganda, I enthusiastically planned to build up this faculty. Went back home and my rector, Professor Guido Trombetti, accepted the challenge without ever been in Africa. He actually helped me to write a memorandum of understanding to support the birth of the faculty. And the faculty was open with very little means the 4th of October 2004. From that single day, we've been regularly attending in the faculty with 38 Neapolitan professors giving lectures, compact courses of lectures to the medical students and supporting the growth of the Ugandan faculty with Ugandan lecturers and professors, which is now well set up. We have 32 professors on staff in the Ugandan Faculty of Medicine, and we have 310 students, and 58 of them will see the graduation ceremony next year.
You're being awarded this prize in this ceremony commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What is perhaps the significance of this for you and for your work?
Well, today is a very important day because we are now building the future of this adventure. We are now supporting the future of this adventure. We are building up now, we just had a meeting, setting up the foundation of the postdoc, which is crucial in Africa. You have to set up an environment to allow medical doctors to stay in the place and not leave for UK very easily or for Australia or South Africa.
The nomination which we are receiving took all of us by surprise. So really, it simply means that whatever humble thing you are doing, there are people who are seeing it. So all in all, we are very grateful for this nomination. And it has sort of humbled us, and it has sort of also, it's going to encourage us to work even harder.
And my thanks there to Professor Luigi Greco from Naples University, to Professor Jack Nieko Penmorge, and Professor Jasper Ogwal Okeng, both from the University of Gulu in northern Uganda. Harvesting the fruits of 40 years of ecumenical dialogue. That's the ambitious theme of a report under discussion this week at the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. In the years immediately following the Second Vatican Council, four international bilateral conversations were started between the Catholic Church and leaders of the Lutheran, Methodist, Anglican, and Reformed churches. Over the decades since then, all four of those dialogues have produced a wealth of written agreements on many areas of church life and ministry. But above all, they've developed a climate of friendship and trust, overcoming four centuries of bitter divisions and often violent conflict. So just where is the ecumenical movement headed today, now that the enthusiasm of the early years has given way to a more sober assessment of the obstacles hindering progress towards full Christian unity? What should church leaders be doing to translate this progress into practical action in the pews and parishes, as well as at regional or international levels?
People must become flesh in the body of the church, and this means it's not enough to have documents of paper. We do not produce these documents for the shelves.
Cardinal Walter Kasper is president of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity. He told me the purpose of this plenary assembly and of the Harvest Report is to initiate a real process of reception for the progress that has been made so far.
The theme of our plenary is reception and future of the ecumenical movement. And when we look back to the more than 40 years now since the Second Vatican Council, we have to say with great gratitude to the Lord that we were donated with many gifts of the Lord, because we are today in a totally new situation of friendship and closeness to more or less all other churches or church communities, notwithstanding all difficulties and open questions. And so we have to look back, with especially to the relations with Oriental churches, Oriental Orthodox and Orthodox churches, and we can say that we are on a good way of hope in this situation, and we want to go ahead in this direction, which we initiated with the Ravenna document, and will continue next year in a meeting in Cyprus about the primacy of Rome in the first millennium. We have also to look back to the relations with churches or church communities coming from the Reformation of the 16th century. We produced in the last months a huge document of more than 100 pages in English about all the dialogues we had with the mainline churches. This means the Anglicans, Lutherans, Reformed, and the Methodists. What we have achieved about Jesus Christ and the Holy Trinity, about justification, sanctification, and salvation, about the Church and about the sacraments. It means baptism and Eucharist. And I personally was very astonished how much this is. But we, at the end, we had to make an evaluation what we have achieved and where there are still important open questions. And this document, we call it Harvest Document, we will present to the plenary. It will be discussed, and then it has to be elaborated, and we think we will publish it as a stimulus for the future of the dialogue, because this document tells us where we are and then also where we should go. We sent it already to some friends of the other churches or church communities, and the echo, as we received up to now, was very positive, was enthusiastic, because they want since a long time that we initiate a reception process. It's not enough to have documents of paper, but we do not produce these documents for the shelves or for future doctorates, but we want that it will take knowledge, that it will be discussed, perhaps also criticized, but then it will realized within the church. The paper must become flesh in the body of the church, and this means reception, this process of reception. We want to initiate with this document, and now we look forward to the discussion in the plenary and then elaboration of the document, and we hope it will be an impulse and that there will create also some new enthusiasm about the ecumenical pilgrimage.
Just a few weeks ago, Anglican bishops, 30 of them, and 30 of our bishops, Roman Catholic bishops, we had a day together to pray and to talk and to reflect. Oh, that's good.
Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor is Archbishop of Westminster and has been involved in the Anglican-Catholic dialogue in the UK for over 3 decades. He says despite the many difficulties, it's essential to push ahead with this reception process.
With regard to the Anglican dialogue, which I've been intimately associated, having been co-chairman of what they called ARCIC for 17 years, I would say so near and yet so far, that the documents that we produced on matters of crucial importance and of Eucharist and ministry and authority and morals and a number of others, but the Anglican communion at the present time is afflicted with great disunity within itself for all sorts of reasons. And so we have to ask ourselves in terms of the dialogue, what kind of church are we dealing with? Where is the focus of authority and unity within the Anglican Church, which enables us to have a dialogue, the fruits of which can be ratified. Ratified, yes, within the Catholic Church, but also ratified within the Anglican Communion. That, at the moment, is a very great challenge. So even though I think the dialogue, in many ways, has gone very well in terms of the documents produced, I don't think those documents have been fully received within the Anglican Communion, and therefore further progress, I think, on that level, I think, is going to be difficult.
What about how far they've been fully received within the Catholic Church? As you say, they're mainly on paper, the results of this dialogue, aren't they? How do you get from paper into people's lives?
I think that can only be done through Catholic universities, through theologians. Also, I think with some of the fruits of some of the dialogues, even within parishes, you have groups that study the documents. We had that in many years ago, studying the document on the Eucharist and a document on authority. And so I think that's another way where they can be received. But I think of latter years, this hasn't happened. And I think it's more difficult for the Anglicans than for us, because the documents, I must say, I think are fully conversant with Catholic theology and Catholic doctrine.
How much has this ecumenical work been a priority for you over your years in Westminster?
I think it's been a priority ever since I became a bishop 32 years ago, so I've been in this a long time. And partly, of course, through the Anglican dialogue. And now at Westminster, because you really confronting, as we do, the kind of secular society in Britain, Christians need to stand up together. And so I try as much as I can to cooperate with the Archbishop of Canterbury and so that we stand up not just for Christianity, but indeed for all religion in our society, where a strong minority would like to, as it were, ostracize or privatize religion totally.
So you're saying, in fact, that secularism and atheism in a paradoxical way has helped the ecumenical movement, perhaps even the interreligious dialogue in Britain today?
I would have said yes. I think we see that we have something that we must defend in common, even though we don't agree, of course, with many things, particularly with people of other religions. But at the same time, there are matters about belief in God, matters about family, matters about the structure of society, which I think we have a lot in common.
You talk about the church or the churches being under threat today. How serious a threat do you see this as?
Well, I think there are pro and con. I mean, it's a good thing in some ways, because if you're swimming against the stream, you've got to be in there swimming against it. And in that sense, I think that it's quite good for the Catholic Church. I'm talking about the Catholic Church in Britain, as it were, to be up against it. And therefore it means that people have got to give an account of the hope that's in them. And one of the things I would like to think will happen more and more, that educated and Catholic lay men and women will be able to speak out more and witness more in public life. I think it's very necessary. Of course, the downside is that it's very hard to get one's views accepted, particularly about social and moral matters.
Looking back at the progress that's been made and working closer together, as you say, with other denominations, helps to focus more sharply, more clearly on the way ahead as well. What do you see as the main obstacles and the main direction that this dialogue should be taking now?
Well, I think that's the purpose of our meeting. I think that this the document harvest we're going to examine during these next couple of days, what's the fruits of these dialogues and what is the way ahead. Not just within our own countries, but here at the Council for Christian Unity, what are the steps that they should be taking in the years ahead? So I think I can't be definitive about that. I'm very anxious to hear what my fellow bishops and cardinals say about that.
In your own mind, looking at the situation in England, what do you see today as the biggest obstacles, perhaps, to this dialogue?
Well, I think the biggest obstacle are the divisions within other churches, and particularly with the Church of England, or the Anglican Church. That's been so that it's very hard to make fundamental progress. On the other hand, to put it another way, spiritual progress of talking together, praying together, being together, I think that grows the whole time. And just a few weeks ago, Anglican bishops, 30 of them, and 30 of our bishops, Roman Catholic bishops, we had a day together to pray and to talk and to reflect.
Can you tell us anything more about the fruits of that day together?
Well, I think the fruits are that that when we want to have a common Christian mind, that what happens is that the kind of connections that we make in these days, I think, bear fruit then.
My thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, Archbishop of Westminster. And earlier you heard Cardinal Walter Kasper, President of the Vatican's Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.